What image pops into your mind when I utter these two words? Eating disorder. Like me, did you imagine a young girl or a young adult woman? I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard. Eating disorders can surface in any one of us, regardless of age, ethnicity, race, gender, or socioeconomic standing. We'll talk about who's at risk and how you might be able to intercede or even prevent a loved one from falling into this dangerous downward spiral. We'll talk about how media influences our images of health, and we'll talk about Facebook's influence on eating habits. Eating disorders can lead to serious lifelong physical damage, even death. The good news is that the public seems to recognize it as an illness, not an attitude tied to vanity. Psychologist Dr. Bruce Leese joins us, but first the news. What image comes to mind when I say these two words? Eating disorder. If you conjured up an image of a young, affluent white woman, you were on target because eating disorders affect this demographic more than any other. However, this is a problem without boundaries. It affects women, men, young people, older individuals, gays, straights, people of color, as well as the white population. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. Our resident psychologist, Dr. Bruce Leese, joins us for this conversation, and welcome back to the studios.
Thank you so much. You know, I always enjoy being here.
Dr. Leese is a psychologist and professor of family medicine at KU Med Center. He's also currently engaged in research on binge eating, and more on that in a few minutes. So you were nodding your head as I opened the show. So let's talk first about who is vulnerable to developing eating disorders.
You know, it's almost a matter of who isn't. The challenge of eating in general is that it provides a great deal of satisfaction. Instead of just meeting a biophysiological need, nourishment, we in this country in particular have turned food into probably one of the biggest reward systems there is.
So anybody. Okay, immediate gratification.
Exactly. The immediate gratification makes little kids want to eat, makes older people want to eat, makes, you know, we make things with lots of fats and we make things with lots of sugars. And, you know, there's been research on how appealing those high density caloric items are, even for other primates besides humans.
So today we're going to be talking primarily about three eating disorders, correct, Bruce?
Yes, it'll be anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating. And binge eating often leads to obesity, though in some people it doesn't. Some people will binge eat and then starve themselves and then binge eat. And we treat that as different from bulimia in that binge eating, to just be binge eating doesn't end with some kind of purge behavior, whereas bulimia does.
Okay, well, go deeper on that. So I engage, you know, I would have to argue we all engage in binge eating from time to time.
That's what I argue that also. I've talked to so many people about binge eating, and they act like, wow, that sounds like a really rare disorder. But I don't know anyone who hasn't eaten to the point where they're uncomfortable, to the point where they've had to unbutton their slacks.
I was at a birthday party this weekend, and I was full on the appetizers. But, of course, I sat down and ate a full course.
That's what we do because it's so immediately gratifying.
Okay. Using that as an example, that's an occasional occurrence for me. Do I have a tendency, or is this just – should a red flag be going up? You know, my flagpole.
Well, a binge eating disorder involves ongoing, frequent episodes of out of control eating.
Frequent,
yeah.
Okay.
And at least once a week, there's a relatively new diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and really, people who do it on a regular basis often feel guilty. Ashamed, they don't feel good about themselves afterwards. It may haunt them for some time to come. So,
yeah,
that's much different in terms of the time and the course than somebody who just binge eats at a party or Thanksgiving or Christmas.
What is the psychology behind binge eating? Why do I engage in binge eating?
People most likely to binge eat are people who are trying to restrict their eating because they, for example, want to lose weight. They may want to diet. If you eat properly, what you'll do is eat maybe 4 to 6 very light meals a day and never really let yourself get that hungry. The other thing that happens is people get hooked on, again, these high density, high calorie foods. Mm-hmm. That, you know, it becomes a habit, and then when that's digested, they're craving the next chocolate candy or the next bag of French fries.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the results, what happens?
Well, your body takes a longer time to feel full than it probably should.
Okay,
you keep eating thinking I'm not full yet, or the great taste or the texture in your mouth or the along with taste the salt or the sweetness, depending on your vulnerability to overeating or binging, that really overrides. Ultimately, the brain is the boss. The mind is the boss. So no matter how full you might be, if your mind says, oh, you can eat another one of those, they're so delicious.
Mm-hmm. Work it off later.
Yeah, well, you know, at the moment people are binging, at the time they're doing that, they've usually kind of gone past that what's going to happen later thing. And it's more of a fight between I'm full, no, I'm not, yes, I am, no, I'm not, it would taste so good. You know, it's a vulnerability that occurs because of how, like I said, how reinforcing food is. But it also fills a need for people who may not have adequate rewards in other areas of their lives.
Could it be related to a low self-esteem?
You know, low self-esteem is kind of a global concept. More often, it's a feeling of anxiety. It's a feeling of stress. It's a feeling of some kind of tension, and it's an effort to reduce that tension. So the food is a tremendous distractor. As you think about, I would challenge anyone to think about their absolute favorite food and then think about how rewarding it is to consume that, and especially if something's on your mind. It's like, I need a break right now.
Right.
That's a very appealing and easy break.
I saw a statistic that indicated close to 50% of those with eating disorders are probably dealing with some level of depression.
Well, it's a vicious cycle, because to the extent that we are able to control compulsive behaviors like eating, and I say compulsive mm-hmm. intentionally. We all as humans are compelled to eat.
Mm-hmm.
So to the extent that we feel like or believe that we aren't controlling those compulsions well or those demands well, it is depressing to a lot of people. And then those people in a vicious cycle fashion will then eat to feel better. They say, what the heck, I can't control this anyway, or I'll start tomorrow. That's where I'll exercise tomorrow, or I'll start tomorrow, seems to come in, where people violate their diet or their desire to abstain from sweets or fried foods.
Is binge eating one of the key factors or one of the primary reasons we have an obesity problem in this country?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The just one look at the calories in fast foods that aren't simple salads or simple baked potatoes with nothing on them, or mm-hmm. Just looking at the calories should tell you that, you know, we are overeating. We are overeating, and it's very tempting, and it's right there in front of us, and it seems inevitable.
What are the solutions?
Well, you know, every time I'm on here, I give the same solutions to psychological problems, and I'm not ashamed of that at all. As I said a little while ago, the brain is the executive function of the rest of our bodies, and
mm-hmm.
the way we think determines essentially the way we feel and the way we act. And a substantial, profound, meaningful commitment to change is a good first step in towards that change. Then there are the more mechanical choices, not having high caloric, high density foods right there accessible to us. There are people who will go to the store, and knowing that they shouldn't be eating these things, they will pile them into the basket, the cart, and they'll leave with them. And when you say, what's the cure? Changing behaviors and changing thoughts, which change behaviors. So. Mm-hmm.
But this commitment to change, we may need some help. So I'm assuming some counseling.
I've
heard that there are rehab programs for people that struggle with this.
You know, in all behaviors that are compulsive or addictive or involve immediate gratification, in all of those behaviors, whether we're talking about marijuana, cigarettes, eating, there are levels of distress and also levels of impairment. And somebody who just can't keep that 30 pounds off because they overeat, there's probably not a lot of good reason to go into some kind of treatment program.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that it's really impairing and really problematic, a more intense treatment might be mandated. I mean, there are people who go away to camps, and these are adults and children, where the food is restricted and the exercise is mandated, and the outcomes are pretty good, though they may be short-lived. So depending on the extent of the eating disorder, just like the extent of a drinking problem or cigarette smoking, the degree of treatment should correspond well with the actual level of impairment and in the problem.
And I'm assuming pharmaceuticals are an option as well.
Yeah, pharmaceuticals are an option. And surgery, actually.
Surgery,
for
yeah.
people who are over 100 pounds overweight, it's sometimes, in many people, the only way that they'll get relief from morbid obesity. So, and I get a lot of referrals, actually. I'll get referrals from Mayo Clinic because Mayo does a lot of the surgeries, and they are good to make sure that their patients are psychologically aware of what a surgery would involve, that they're not going to eat over the surgery. So if there's any kind of gastric surgery, that people won't still gorge themselves and do themselves harm. So there's a lot of different treatments out there. You brought up medications. I mentioned surgery, psychological, and then what most people do is self-help. They just kind of guide themselves to change.
Our resident psychologist, Dr. Bruce Leese, is sharing his insights into eating disorders. This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Bill Anderson. Your questions are welcome at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Feel free to send an email to centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's talk a little bit about anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. Because those are the other two primary disorders that people deal with in America.
Precisely. People, as I said earlier, oftentimes will use food or any other immediately gratifying item to control or modify or regulate their own mood states.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most people will eat when they're anxious, there are those people who will starve themselves. It makes them feel, and I'm going to use this term over and over again, it gives them a sense of control. So ultimately, whether you're eating more than you should or less than you should, and that is an either of those extremes are your eating disorder, it's an effort to control, in many cases, mood or emotions or anything like that. So,
well, let me list off a few, and you respond. Anger, anxiety, shame, inability to express emotions, someone who feels isolated socially.
Yeah, and I always think of, rather than, larger, more general notions like self-esteem or self-confidence or self-worth, I usually think of what's the emotion in the moment. So, eating is something that can be done in solitude. And the word shame that you used a moment ago is the one that pops into my head. A lot of people, just because of where they are in their lives, realistic or unrealistic, feel ashamed of where they are, and they're isolated and they're home alone, and they may not be working, or they may be working and they're just overwhelmed, but they come home and food is their friend. And that's a concept that you'll see a lot in the literature on eating disorders. Food is a friend, or, you know, the one trusted companion. So, again, you asked about anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa. In anorexia, people have a distorted body image. They view themselves as overweight even when they're dangerously thin. They often refuse to eat, and some engage in compulsive exercise. And all of that is an effort to feel a sense of control, and it's also typically associated with obsessive-compulsive styles, or a style. So somebody who really wants to maintain super-duper control over their emotions, mm-hmm. they may just say, I know that feeling, and I'm familiar with that hungry feeling, and I want to not eat until I don't feel hungry anymore. And bulimia nervosa is eating those excessive quantities, like in binge eating, fearing the calories and the potential weight gain, and then purging with anything, purging with laxatives, purging with diuretics, purging with vomiting or exercising. People who are bulimic are typically secretive, and they're almost always ashamed of the binges and purges. And I mean, you can go into a public restroom in a fancy restaurant and see clues that somebody has been bulimic in the restroom. It's, again, people wanting to maintain a high degree of control, using a compensatory strategy, something to compensate for a skill set that's absent.
And left unchecked, I mean, this can lead to heart problems, to brain damage, even death.
Oh, yeah. There are many severe risks that can correspond with untreated eating disorders. People with anorexia are 18 times more likely to die, 18 times more likely to die than peers who don't have anorexia.
Wow.
Eating disorders can devastate the body. If you want me to name just a few of the diseases, I can sure do that. Anemia, constipation, osteoporosis, those can all occur with anorexia. Bulimia, many people know that it can deteriorate the teeth because of the acids that come up from the stomach that can rot teeth. Esophageal rupture is really a risk for people who make uh-huh. themselves vomit. And binge eating can lead to everything that corresponds with obesity if a person becomes obese.
We received a call, and this caller chose not to be on the air, asked if you go a long stretch, Dr. Leese, without binging or purging, but then relapse once, do you have to start the process of getting better over again? Or are you still kind of considered, in quotations, clean?
One of the interesting things about addictive behaviors, and I clearly think of binge eating as an addictive behavior because of the aforementioned reasons. One of the things that makes addictive behaviors, including binge eating, so interesting to me is that the people who engage in the addictive behavior are a vastly heterogeneous group. So when somebody calls us here and says, do I have to start, you know, the calendar all over again? I've abstained. It really varies from person to person. There are people who are binge eaters, alcoholics, smokers, who will take a puff on a cigarette or two, or they'll have a binge and purge, or they'll drink, you know, a can of beer. And the best thing for them to do is to say, it was just a slip. I've gone for 5 years. You know, I don't consider that a violation. Other people do better thinking, you know, I got to start all over. This was not worth it. So, you know, it's an individualistic thing because people are so different in what causes their addictive behaviors, their binge eating. And so if it helps this woman to say I'm up to 5 years and that was just a blip on the screen, then good for her. That's what she should do. If it helps her to say, you know, you messed up, start again. If that helps her, that's what she should do.
You know what blows my mind is in the media, some media will treat binging as a sport. I mean, who can eat the most Coney Island hot dogs? For crying out loud, it's contested on ESPN television. restaurant promotions. Come in and eat a 17-ounce steak and you eat free. And then, of course, you know, pie eating contests at fairs and so forth, at school fairs and school functions. I mean, it seems like harmless fun on the surface, but maybe there's something we should be concerned about there. I'm not sure.
I think that stuff, I'm a psychologist, but I'm a human being first. I think yes. That stuff is all bizarre. I don't even think of the psychology of it.
Uh-huh.
It's more like, oh man, how can they do that?
I know.
I think like everybody else does.
Yeah. Well, Chris is calling from Lee Summit. He called 235-2888. Chris, you're on the air with Dr. Bruce Lease.
Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have a question actually about an observation. It's just a self-observation. I was watching a documentary one time on crack cocaine, and the person that was talking about how hard it was to stay clean and stuff, she was saying that the problem is the very, very first time you ever take crack, it's like the most amazing high you can imagine, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to get back to that one amazing high.
It's called chasing the high. That's exactly right, Chris.
Chasing the dragon, chasing the high, exactly. So shortly thereafter, I'm eating a piece of chocolate cake, and the very first piece, the very first bite I have, it's like the most amazing. By the time I'm done with it, the last three or four, not so good, and yet I finished it. And I wonder if I'm chasing the chocolate, if I'm kind of having the same psychological response. It's like, wow, that first bite was so good. You know, maybe if I just keep eating it, I'll replicate that first bite.
Well, you're giving me a chance, Chris, to really continue talking about my favorite part of all of these problems, and that's the way the mind works, the way people think. I've never heard anyone analyze the first bite and the rest of the bites looking to taste like the first bite. I think it's interesting. I certainly don't dispute it, and I'm glad you mentioned it. I think a lot of times tasty food continues to be reinforcing from the first French fry to the last French fry and I'm not a French fry eater, to the last French fry in the bag. And I think oftentimes that last French fry leaves a person feeling disappointed, like, oh, no more. I wish there was another one. So I don't know about that first bite thing in a specific episode of eating. I will tell you.
Well, I have heard that from nutritionists, that the first bite is always the most gratifying. I have heard that.
That's so great.
I don't know. Anyway, just food for thought. Thank you. Oh, hey, there was a pun. Food for thought.
Very good.
Anyway,
yeah.
Thank you.
You get a gold star for that.
Thanks, Chris. Nice phone call. Our phone number is 816-235-2888. You know, NPR's Morning Edition had a segment on about peer pressure with America's youth. And, you know, they virtually live online. That's how they socialize now. And it cited research into peer pressure as it relates to drinking and smoking. But I saw another study. This was a Florida State research paper that concluded that at least one form of social media, Facebook, has been associated with higher levels of eating disorders. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah. So let's just review that. So
yeah,
people who spend more time on Facebook or hit kind of a red line where they spend X number of hours.
Yeah, usually I think they characterized it as an hour or more.
Yeah, it's a sedentary per day. It's a sedentary activity, which certainly would have something to do with it. I would think that would be the case. I don't know, you know, I don't know how scientific that is, but, you know, it's interesting. If I had all the time in the world to study everything interesting, that would probably be one of the things I would study. But it's an interesting thought.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more about binge eating. You mentioned that it could be tied to low self-esteem and there are some other factors, but, you know, how does this connect to vanity or just, you know, plain and simple body image?
I would start out by assuming that the consumption of food in an unhealthy way, whether it's binging and purging, or starving oneself, again, is an effort to control. So I would think of it as an effort to control what one feels. I would say that again, I'd look at it as a pie, actually, and some of the portion of the pie would be I want to control my feelings. I think for some people, vanity is a real factor where it comes to anorexia or even bulimia, where you eat to get that control, or you don't eat to get that control, but you also, there's a certain degree of vanity. Old guys like us, Bill, don't worry about whether we look good anymore. We don't, do we?
Not so much.
Yeah.
It's pointless.
A lot of people most people that have anorexia are busy looking in the mirror saying, oh, my arms are too fat, my face is too fat, this is too fat, that's too fat. I mean, that is vanity. And hopefully people reach a level of maturity in their lives, or age in our case, where we just say, you know what, we are who we are, and it should be for health, not for vanity. So vanity plays a role, but control, control, control. It's like location, location, location is what causes people to misuse anything that's immediately gratifying.
Since you disclosed that we're old, I can go here. When we were growing up, models were always paper thin. You probably remember
Twiggy,
yeah. And now I think we see people that are a better representation of the population as a whole. Do you think that in using television in particular, do you think that we have a healthier approach to how we market and promote, it's less damaging?
It's really an interesting phenomenon. When we were young and dinosaurs roamed the earth, when we were young and Twiggy was popular, it was really unhealthy for her and for society for her to be an icon and for anyone to strive to that. Today, I see...
And for those who don't know, Twiggy was a supermodel.
Yeah, she was. And she was clearly anorexic. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's why they called her Twiggy. So, I see people these days who clearly have problems with overeating, and they dress as if they are Twiggy. I mean, the people who are wearing clothing that really reveal that they don't take very good care of themselves. So I think we've swung from undereating to overeating in the years you and I have been adults.
Our phone number is 816-235-2888. When we come back, Ellen and Ann are on the phone lines. Do you have a question about how you might help a loved one who's struggling with an eating disorder? Call now or drop us an email, centralstandard@kcur.org. It's break time. Your calls and more from Dr. Bruce Lease just ahead on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard. Our regular visiting psychologist, Dr. Bruce Lease, is here talking about eating disorders. And we've been talking about who's at risk, how to identify it. And I'd like to kind of lean in now more and talk more about how we can identify and help someone that we suspect is in trouble, Dr. Lease. First, let me give the phone number, 816-235-2888, and centralstandard@kcur.org is the way to reach us with an email comment or question. So let's talk about it. I suspect somebody, a friend, a dear friend, is struggling with anorexia. Let's just use that as an example. How do I address this? How do I approach this person?
I'll start by saying that I have really struggled with when I know somebody really well, particularly with obesity. If I know I struggled for months and never got the courage up to say to a dear friend that I thought he was getting to a point where his health had to be really impaired. So I'm starting out again in answering your question as a person rather than a psychologist. It isn't easy, so I want to acknowledge that. It all boils down to the nature of the relationship between you and that other person. If it's somebody that you are planning to spend your whole life with, that would be my highest priority. To impact somebody that you love, a spouse, a significant other, or a partner of any sort, I would say that you have a ticket to say whatever is good and right for them. And I wouldn't be afraid of doing that because you want the person to be around for a long time. So, passive aggressive is completely contraindicated. You do not do the passive aggressive thing. It's just not right. Uh-huh. You know, asking the person if they've noticed. I wouldn't say, have you noticed you've put on a little weight? I would watch their eating habits. I'd go right to the behavior itself. So if you think someone's anorexic, I know a lot of people who are naturally thin, really thin, those people that everybody describes as very lucky. And I've watched some of those thin people at meals, and they don't eat enough to be bulimic. So I don't think they're going off and purging. But they do eat hefty amounts. And so if you suspect somebody has anorexia, watch their eating habits first. If they just push the food around for 20 minutes and then, you know, get a takeout container, you know that they have some psychological eating issue. Somebody who is binging, watch how they eat. You know, when it comes to the fourth or fifth slice of pizza or two I don't want to use any brand names, but two of the giant hamburgers you can get from mm-hmm. any of the, you know, fast food restaurants. Mm-hmm. Watch the behavior and comment on the behavior. Say, you know, I'm a little concerned about you. You're eating more than usual. You're eating really fast. Are you nervous about something? That's a good way to talk to a binge eater. When a lot of food is gone in the refrigerator and you suspect someone you love is binge eating, I'd say, did you eat all that? And if they go, yeah, I just say, you know, I'm concerned about your health. You've been eating more lately, or you've been eating a lot. I want you to be around for a long time. With strangers and even with your kids, if they're children, you have to be careful about their egos, their little egos.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want them to walk around thinking, I'm not good enough, I'm ugly, I'm fat, or I'm too skinny. It's a delicate process, but there's a responsibility as a parent there to address it. And with friends, that's the hardest category of all, as far as I'm concerned. But you do your best, and if it's a good relationship, you say something, and it goes well.
Ellen's in the air, and she's calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I have a question. For those that aren't able to necessarily incorporate therapy into their daily lives or their schedules, but have identified that they have somewhat of a eating disorder, is there any outside resources you recommend other than therapy, such as books or any particular thing that you recommend someone could do on their own?
Fortunately, eating is one of those psychological and behavioral problems where the resources outside of medicine and psychology, the resources are pretty good. There are a lot of terrific books that demonstrate, as you read them, a lot of insight about the eating problem. Furthermore, the programs that are well integrated, that include exercise, diet, et cetera, a well-integrated program is a good program. So if somebody's schizophrenic or has bipolar illness or they have borderline personality, I wouldn't say, you know, you'll fix that with a self-help approach. You might, but I wouldn't lean that in that direction. But certainly with an eating disorder or addictive behavior, there's a lot of what they call spontaneous recovery, where you go out and do your own thing. And in doing your own thing, not getting help from a doctor, you get better.
Does that help, okay. Ellen?
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the phone call. One of our callers had to hang up, but I got the gist of her question. Not so much a question as a comment. Overcame an eating disorder by engaging in an incredibly positive and busy lifestyle. Any thoughts?
It brings me back to what I promised I would repeat over and over again on the show. You know, unfortunately, we have gone from living to eat, eating to living to eat. We have turned eating into a way of controlling our lives. I wouldn't say better, but controlling our lives. So we like to feel in control, and if we don't feel adequately in control in our lives, we might do a lot of addictive things. Getting busy with meaningful stuff, like that caller mentioned to you, mm-hmm. that's the right way to do it. Get involved in things that give your life meaning, where food is not as salient. It's not as important. It's not as even it's not in the front of your mind. It's in the back of your mind.
But eating is so important to so many cultures, to religious culture, to when we celebrate birthdays. There's generally a big meal at all the holidays. It's about gathering around the dining room table.
Oh, yeah. I've taught in Japan. I've taught in Japan. I've taught in Taiwan and in Europe. And, you know, I'll never forget the gigantic tables with the – we call them Lazy Susans, the circular thing on ball bearings where you can just spin the food around. And that was in China and Taiwan. And then in Japan, they had little trains. They had a little train that went around the restaurant and you'd pick your plate off the train, you know. And
I'm sorry, I'm laughing.
No, I am too. So, yes, in many cultures, food is very significant, important, and so.
So it's just a question of managing that and balancing it and realizing that, hey, it's important to use discipline, self-discipline, when I go out tonight to celebrate this birthday.
You know, I like to think, in response to what you just said, I like to think that life is precious, it's temporary, our bodies are very fragile, even though we feel like we're until you're our age, back to that thing.
You don't have to go back there anymore if you don't care to.
Most people are not willing to connect their current behaviors with the later impact, and so I like to encourage people, including myself, to think: if you do this now, here's what will happen later. If you eat more than you need to eat, you are taking the risk of shortening your own life. And that's not a risk I'm excited about taking.
I'm Bill Anderson. Glad you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. Psychologist and professor of family medicine at KU Med Center, Dr. Bruce Lease, is here. Our conversation is about eating disorders. And if you have a question or a comment, we invite you to phone 816-235-2888. That's what Bill did. Bill joins us from Leawood. You're on the air, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Bill had a question about anorexia, and as it relates to a young person. If we look only at social media, there's a lot of peer pressure. And if they're watching a lot of television, they're seeing images of people who prioritize looking really great. Thoughts?
Yeah. My experience, and I emphasize my experience, this is not research-based, but my experience has been, and I've treated a lot of people with anorexia, my experience has been, again, that it's all about control. It's not about being a cute little child and looking at, you know, TV or the movie or Facebook or any of those things or the internet and going, oh, she looks so pretty because she's thin. It's more of, this is something I can control. This is something that it gives me gratification to go all day and to feel, I have watched people make it a habit to check their ribs, you'll see people with eating disorders, they'll be sitting around and oftentimes they'll run their hand across their stomach area, their abdomen. And they're feeling something that's familiar to them, and just feeling the ribs, feeling the muscles in the stomach. Because even if they're not well developed muscles, until you lose all your muscles, if you're really thin, you feel muscle there. It's almost a lot of it is the reinforcement after the reinforcement of surviving the hunger, of feeling the effects. Now they then deny those effects. What happens is, I'll use a big word here: habituate. It becomes a habit to feel what they feel, and then it no longer packs that same punch. So, I feel my tummy. I don't, but I might feel those pronounced stomach muscles and the ribs, and go, "Wow, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I'm mastering the universe." Mm-hmm. Then after doing that a couple hundred times, no longer is it enough. It's like, well, I'm still too fat. So it's a very complex psychological process that goes beyond watching media. I have almost never met somebody with anorexia that didn't have some family history of high achievement or anxiety or obsessive compulsive tendencies. Some of the most profoundly anorexic young people I've worked with have extremely successful parents, and I suspect they don't think they can ever achieve what their parents can, but they sure can achieve control over eating.
CentralStandard@kcur.org is the email address. And we received this, Bruce, anonymously. I had a former problem with bulimia. My father made comments about me and my mother's weight. What role and responsibility does the family have in supporting recovery? Should we not talk about the issue at all as a follow-up during the recovery process? And what are the best ways to support people who are struggling with eating disorders? And you touched down lightly on this earlier in the show, but I think it bears, going a little deeper.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan, as you might guess, of communication, and in particular of meaningful interpersonal communication. It's what I try to do all day, every day with people. So I would encourage all people who care about each other to talk on a regular basis, not all the time, on a regular basis about meaningful stuff, including problems. And especially when somebody's solving their problems, it's a really important time to communicate about solving their problems. Anytime I see somebody who's solved their drinking problem, I make it a point to say congratulations. I even know somebody as an acquaintance who told me that he quit drinking, and I each time I say him, I say, how's it going? And congratulations. So people should support each other in making life changes, and they do so by communicating with each other, I would hope.
Let's go back to the phone lines, and we've got Michael calling from Kansas City. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Hi, Michael.
I have two comments. The first is I have a binging eating disorder, and it's people feel alone when they have an eating disorder, and I think especially so when you have a binging disorder, because I think the general public really thinks of eating disorders as bulimia and anorexia, and they don't understand, why don't you just stop eating? Why do you keep filling your plate? Those sorts of things. And it's a very, very lonely feeling. And the other piece of that is that eating disorders really have a voice, and all eating disorders manifest differently, but that voice, I even call it Ed. And he is incredibly destructive, and the pain that comes along with an eating disorder is just tremendous. It doesn't matter if you're eating too much or not eating enough. Mm. And the other thing I wanted to warn listeners of is to one of the people talking earlier said, observe and, tell someone that you're worried and those sorts of things. The most hurtful time I've ever experienced my eating disorder is when I'm about to put food in my mouth and someone says, you're eating too much. Or I've already filled my plate and I'm sitting around a table and then someone brings it up.
Michael, are you also obese? Because that makes it even more difficult.
I am. I'm obese. In 2007, I had lap band surgery, which helped a little bit, and now it's causing complications. And
right.
I don't recommend surgeries unless it's absolute last resort.
Absolutely,
but that's another piece to it all. And so every time I put anything in my mouth, I'm reminded of my size. I'm reminded of my eating disorder, and in addition to what I do with inside, it's incredibly embarrassing when your pants split or, all of those other pieces do it. So I just want to warn listeners that to pick the appropriate time where they can be empathetic and talk about it when there's not food being chewed.
Well, Michael, that's it's great that you called. Thank you. And I'm not a big fan of medicalizing everything, calling everything that troubles people a disease. I will tell you that it just appears that certain addictive behaviors seem to have a pretty strong genetic component. And obesity is clearly one of them. You know, some people have a predisposition to get headaches. Some people get hypertension. Some people get anxious. Some people get heart disease. I think that, and I'm not a genetic researcher, and I'm not a biopsychologist, but, you know, it's somebody who gets so obese that they need lap band surgery probably had the misfortune of having some predisposition to morbid obesity. And I'll congratulate you for anything you've done that's been successful and hope you continue to do good things for yourself.
Yeah, and Michael, I hope you have a most pleasant week, and thank you for sharing. Bruce, I read somewhere that men are less likely to seek help because of the perception that they have a woman's illness.
Well, in general, men are taught, they're socialized to not be vulnerable and say, I need help with things. They are reluctant to let people hold the 2x4 that they're trying to nail into something. So, you know, men just don't like to ask for help. And I'm sure there are a lot of reasons why they don't ask for help with a lot of mental, emotional, and psychological challenges.
And the reality is that something like 5 to 15% of those suffering with anorexia or bulimia are male. So,
yes. And we, like you said earlier, we don't associate men with anorexia. And I have treated men who have anorexia, and some of them are actually surprised that they have it. Pre-adolescent boys comprise 25% of people with anorexia. Mm-hmm. So a quarter of all people with anorexia, usually young people, are pre-adolescent boys.
Psychologist Dr. Bruce Lease is here as one of our regulars on KCUR and Central Standard. Eating disorders, that's the focal point of our conversation today on Central Standard. Michelle is calling in from Independence. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to bring up a point that when the doctor said that I had anorexia nervosa when I was younger and was hospitalized for it a couple times. And the comment about it kind of being a narcissistic thing, looking in the mirror all the time.
I didn't say narcissistic. I don't think of it at all as being a narcissistic disorder, even a little bit. So I apologize if I misspoke. So certainly I've never associated ever in my career anorexia with narcissism.
Okay, because my thing was I was diagnosed with like a body dysmorphia problem.
Right.
So I never see my body as it really is, you know, so if I'm too thin, it doesn't look too thin to me. If I'm heavier, it doesn't look heavier to me. I never really fully see it, you know, the real way. And so that led to a lot of my problem at the time, and partly control, too, because my life was spinning out of control at the time. But, you know, I just wanted to make sure that clarified. I'm glad you clarified that.
Oh, yeah. I think what you just described makes sense. There are people who misperceive their body shape and size, and it's you label the disorder accurately. It's the body dysmorphic disorder.
Thanks for the phone call.
Sure, thank you.
Have a nice day, Michelle. Hey, tell us a little bit about this research project that you're engaged in at KU Med Center.
Oh, thanks. I'd be happy to. In the Department of Family Medicine at KU Med, we've gotten Institutional Review Board approval to do a study on binge eating, and it will be at no charge. It will be for people that binge eat at least once a week and don't also have bulimia. It's
strictly binge eating.
Yes.
Okay.
There's no medicine or surgery involved. It's a brief intervention, so it's not an ongoing therapy thing. Like I said earlier,
no fees associated with this.
No fees. It's
okay.
Free. Totally free. In fact, the doctors who provide it are volunteering. Everyone who's involved, including me, are volunteering for it. We don't get any.
How far along are you in this?
We'll be starting it next month.
Okay.
So it hasn't even started yet. Anybody who's interested can send me an email, belease@kumc.edu.
And what's driving this research? Why are you doing this?
Well, it's really a wonderful opportunity to combine a lot of things that are important to me. Number one, teaching our family medicine residents how to counsel people is a big commitment in my career, and it'll be family medicine residents that will be providing the therapy. So it helps us teach them how to help people with this problem. I'm also a professor in the psychology department in Lawrence, and the students are very interested in honing their research skills. So it's the perfect intersection of the resources we have and a problem that's very common out there.
I want to get an email in from Kate. She writes, what about the excessive reward system in elementary schools? Teachers frequently hand out cookies, candy, and other treats. They've actually said no in respect to their daughter getting treats, mom and dad have. But the school district won't comply, apparently. And so what about the long-term effects of using food as a reward in the 30 seconds we have remaining?
It's not optimal. You know, I get a coffee credit card. I get a little $5 coffee cards from a coffee shop in town and give them to my graduate students, who are the first ones to get their assignments in each week, just for fun. And it doesn't motivate them. It's just kind of a good laugh, and they get a cup of coffee out of it. And mm-hmm. I don't think we ought to use extrinsic outside motivations to try to get people to do things that are good for them. I think we ought to teach them the intrinsic value.
And the short answer here, people who may not have the means, people who may be deep in poverty, do they have the same access as you and I to these kind of programs and to getting help?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because that's why I work at KU Med, because we do serve some of our patients are underserved, and even this study had those people in mind. So, yes, they're underserved.
Dr. Bruce Leese, a professor of family medicine at KU Medical Center. Bruce, always a pleasure.
Always my pleasure.
You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from kcur.org/centralstandard. Tune in tomorrow as we explore how the best educated kids in the world got that way. Up to Date is next with the Book Doctors. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Christy Garten with Kate Baxendale. Follow me on Twitter. My handle is KCURPD. Thanks. I'm Bill Anderson. This is KCUR.